TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Norman Finkelstein and Chris Hedges discuss Israel and Gaza at Princeton University. They spoke on March 28, 2024, before an overflow audience. Here, highlights from an almost two-hour event, streamed live and archived by the Real News Network. Norman Finkelstein is the author of many books, including The Holocaust Industry and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. He received his PhD from Princeton and has held faculty positions at Brooklyn and Hunter Colleges and Rutgers and New York Universities. Finkelstein's personal experience shaped his life. His mother survived the Majdanek concentration camp. His father survived Auschwitz. He is Chris Hedges.
I want to ask about the United States. It's clearly complicit in sustaining the genocide. I think 67 or 68% of the weapons stockpiles come from the U.S. And the obsequiousness of both parties towards Israel's demands, I'm just going to quote Ariel Sharon and then have you comment. He told Shimon Peres, quote, "Every time we do something, you tell me Americans will do this and will do that. I want to tell you something very clear. Don't worry about American pressure on Israel. We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it."
It has been a question for many people. Why is Biden acquitting himself in the fashion that he is? And for that matter, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, and the rest. I would say there are two elements. One element is there is a strategic interest by the United States to seeing that Israel's deterrence capacity is restored after October 7th. And our administration does see Iran as a crucial regional power that has to be put in its place. And there is the fear in the U.S. administration, from the vantage point of its own interests, there is the fear that a victory for Hamas will embolden what's called the resistance front. So that is, I think, a distinct and separate U.S. interest. And in addition, and here I'll freely admit to going into speculative terrain, and some people may be offended by it. It's my honest opinion, and we can argue over facts. We are obviously in an election cycle. And as everybody knows, if you open up, say, the front page of the New York Times today, the first thing they're always calculating is which party is getting more campaign contributions. And today, the Times breathed a big sigh of relief. Joe Biden is getting ahead now of Trump. I'm not sure if in just the current month or totals, I didn't read the full article. There is a Jewish billionaire class. And since October 7th, it's gone mad. That's not an exaggeration. It is impossible to find an example in American history of not one, but two Ivy League college presidents who were toppled in real time, in your face, coups. The president of Harvard University was ousted from office because she was insufficiently repressive, suppressive of a speech and assembly on her campus. That's completely unprecedented. It was the grossest, most egregious, the most flagrant violation of academic freedom in our country's history. There's nothing that even compares to it. I have studied that history. I've written on that history. At the turn of the century, the robber barons, when I say the turn of the century, I mean from the 19th to the 20th century, the robber barons got very upset because there was a lot of labor insurgency, and there were just a handful of professors, really, you can count them in the fingers of your hand, who in their university posts were expressing some support for the labor insurgencies, and the robber barons were ruthless in trying to get them expelled from the university. And that was the beginnings of the whole battle for academic freedom of our country, was the formation of the AAUP, the American Association of University Presidents. John Dewey and several others played a very important role. But this was simply breathtaking. No holds barred, not behind closed doors. They toppled two Ivy League college presidents. They are that ruthless, and they have that much power. Remember, they're giving $100 million at a shot. And for Biden, that's a concern. If he says something too critical of Israel, they'll just give the money to Trump. Because Trump, they know he's an ace in our, ace in the hole. He's going to do for us whatever we want on Israel. So I do think that that is a significant factor in Biden's calculation. And what they did was they tried to do a kind of good cop, bad cop. Biden sticks by Netanyahu. Chuck Schumer is cautiously critical of Israel in general and Netanyahu in particular, because each of them had a designated role in the division of labor. Biden needs to keep the billionaire class. Schumer has to appease that restive base in the Democratic Party, which is not happy with what's going on. So that's how I try to understand what Biden is doing.
Let's talk about Gaza itself. I was in Sarajevo during the war. That was 300 to 400 shells a day. That resulted in about 4 to 5 dead a day and 24 wounded a day. I juxtapose that with Gaza, where it's hundreds of wounded and dead a day. I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that the numbers released by the health ministry in Gaza are a severe undercount, given what are presumably tens of thousands of missing. And also the bombing itself is of such intensity that it's hard to believe it's 30,000. But I want to talk about the reaction of the, except with the exception of Yemen and the Houthis, there is really no resistance. And your parents survived the Holocaust, and your mother was in Auschwitz, right? Was that correct?
Father.
Your father.
My mother was in Majdanek.
In Majdanek. And so in some ways, it does replicate the Holocaust in the sense that the rest of the world does nothing. We are watching this slaughter being live-streamed, and other than rhetorically, and it's worse because, of course, you have the rhetoric, but then you have the arms shipments, the UK, and there are some countries, Canada just announced that they'll cease sending weapons. But nevertheless, it's being sustained. But I want you to draw comparisons in terms of what we're seeing and the reaction.
There are many factors in trying to make an analogy. The fact of the matter is that Hitler couldn't have done what he did without a war. He couldn't have possibly carried out the Final Solution had he not had the cover of a war and the fact that it was being executed, at least in theory, it was being executed, so to speak, behind closed doors. Now, if you were in the German army, if you were in the Wehrmacht, you were on the front. And 50% of the Jews were killed on the front. They weren't killed in the concentration camps. They were just lined up and shot down. So that's, in my opinion, a very thin alibi that you didn't know what was going on. But at least you can call it an alibi. You can grasp something. Here, there's no alibi. It's being done right out in the open. There's nowhere to hide in this current round. And a significant number of UN officials are saying it out loud. It took them quite a while to say it, but now they're saying it out loud. This is a genocide, a mass starvation. So in that respect, it's actually worse now because it's being just out in the open. And we have the facts, we have the figures. We don't have just the Hamas Ministry of Health. There have been three very systematic, stringent, exhaustive studies done, and they said the Hamas Ministry of Health numbers are right. It's not a speculative fact. Now,
I just want to say that what they record is only out of the morgue hospitals.
Yeah.
So that's
no, but
confined.
I'm saying to the extent that we use the Hamas numbers, they've been confirmed by three independent, stringent studies. Now, when I was in a debate with Benny Morris and I mentioned the figure of 30,000, he said, oh, we could have killed 500,000 if we wanted to. And I said, that's not really true because there's a gap that separates the wish from the deed. It's called politics. And the international community, it exists and it puts constraints. We all wish there were much more significant, those constraints. But I said, considering what you've accomplished, when you look at the numbers, more children killed in Gaza since October than every single war zone in the world added together times four. That's not a small achievement. More journalists killed than all of World War II. That's not a small achievement. More medics killed than in any other conflict zone in the world in any year's time. The density of the bombing, unparalleled in the 21st century. The intensity of the bombing, it exceeds the bombing of Dresden. So, even though you haven't gotten your 500,000, I would say you're doing pretty well. As genocides go, you're doing a pretty good job. Now, some people want to say, well, the ICJ said only a plausible case of genocide. And they try to claim it's a low standard plausibility. I would say to any person in the room, if I were to say to you, there's a plausible case that you murdered your neighbor, you would take that claim pretty seriously. You wouldn't dismiss it. Well, what do you mean by plausible? No, it's just such a stupid argument. Plausible means credible. That's a pretty serious charge. Yes, it's true. The Minister of Antiquities, he wanted to nuke Gaza. And that was not permissible. But that's not because they don't want to. It's the limits imposed by the international political system. What we know is they've gone as far as they want to go before they're stopped, because we know exactly what they wanted to do. It's one of those rare cases of truth in advertising. Defense Minister Gallant said, we will not allow any food, fuel, water, or electricity into Gaza. Well, it doesn't require rocket science to understand what's the consequence of that. Now you're going to say, but they're letting it in. Yeah, but go back and remember, they let it in when Biden said you have to let something in. And at this moment in time, they're not letting it in. Starvation is being used as a weapon. So, all things said, I would say they're doing a very good job if their goal is a genocide.
Well, they cut the humanitarian aid shipments last month by 44%.
Yeah, between the ICJ opinion and now the ICJ opinion, International Court of Justice opinion, one of the two provisional requirements imposed on Israel was to allow more humanitarian aid to get in. In fact, it was reduced by half between February and March. And that was just going to, I want to just say one last part. I talked to the bleak part of the present picture. There are some extraordinarily inspiring things. Number one, the incredible courage, tenacity, conscientiousness of the young people who have been coming out day in and day out in support of the people of Gaza. It's absolutely breathtaking. I figure at some point it'll get boring, people will move on, and the young people keep coming out and coming out and coming out. I went to a demonstration about 2 weeks ago. It was at NYU, New York University, in Washington Square Park. It was pouring rain. And I see you two. But I didn't see anybody over 25 there, but there were umbrellas, so it was a little, I was like in Grandma and Munchkin Land. It was a Saturday. It was pouring rain. We started at 12. We ended at 5:30. And you know what? We then went, or a large number of us, descended into the subway. It ended at New York Public Library at 42nd Street. And on one side of the train platform and on the other side, they were still shouting. Still all the energy level. And I remember I was with somebody and he said to me, and you know, they have no stake in this. They get no gain. There's no gain. You know the expression, of course you know it, of your generation, friends with benefits. This was solidarity without benefits. It was really a deeply inspiring thing. A second data point is South Africa. When people were talking about invoking the Genocide Convention, I said, oh, forget it. What are you talking about? What state is going to come to the defense of Gaza in the face of the United States? That's ridiculous. And the South African performance has just been breathtaking. I don't know how many of you have read the application they submitted, the original application. It was 84 pages with literally hundreds of footnotes. It was so exhaustively and impressively documented. They must have had a very large team of people produce that document. And they continue. I don't know how many of you follow. Literally, every 3 weeks, they're back at the ICJ demanding that the ICJ do more. And they have all the footnoted documents. Israel just released its response 2 days ago, and Israel was bristling now at South Africa. You're getting out of hand. They should be worried about being nuked also, I'm afraid. And the third thing, which was totally, I always freely admit to when I'm wrong because I like to be wrong for a good cause. When people ask, how do you think it's going to go in the International Court of Justice? I said, maybe you could squeak by an 8-7 vote. That's the most. And I didn't believe it. I thought it would be 6-4 and the rest against. And lo and behold, the vote turned out to be 15-2. The U.S. was the president of the court, Donahue, and she voted with the majority. How do you explain that? You know, there was a song in the 1960s, famous song, "There's Something Happening Here." And when 15 judges in the ICJ vote to say Israel is plausibly guilty of genocide, and the American judge, the president, goes along with that, that's pretty impressive. And as an indicator of things, and I'll freely say, if there were a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, to be given out now, first and foremost, I would give it to the doctors in Gaza. So many of them from abroad volunteered to go there. A death zone. That's very impressive. Could I have done that? I would feel the moral pressure, but I think the fear would get the better of me. Second, I would give it to the South Africa delegation. And third, I would give it to the Houthis. Oh, I'm not saying that as a throwback to my days as a Maoist. I'm saying that as a human being. Remember, in the 1990s, there was this whole doctrine which was propagated by liberals, like the Samantha Powers type. It was called Responsibility to Protect, R2P. Well, what are the Houthis doing? The idea was you have a responsibility to protect people who are being threatened with genocide. Isn't that what the Houthis are doing? Protecting, they are fulfilling their responsibility to protect. The Genocide Convention says every signatory has a responsibility to prevent genocide. That's what the Houthis are doing. So, now you might ask why they're doing it. You could speculate, but I think there's one very good reason why they're doing it. You know why? Because what's happening to Gaza happened to them. Between 2015 and 2018, because of the Saudi-US-backed blockade, about 80,000 Yemenis starved to death. They understand starvation. So they would be the third, in my opinion, recipients of that prize.
So we're going to open to questions. Keep them short. Don't give speeches.
I totally support the Houthis as a Jew. You said that, Norm.
Yeah.
Totally. The Houthi flag says, "God is the greatest, death to America, death to Israel, a curse upon the Jews, victory to Islam."
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm aware of
that. How do you reconcile this?
I have no problem reconciling it for this very simple reason, and you'll allow me, you can disagree, I have no problem with that. From my first conscious moments in my own life, okay, my parents loathed the Germans. They didn't loathe the Nazis. They hated the Germans. In fact, I vividly recall my father once recommended me a book on the Nazi Holocaust. And I asked him, you know, what makes this book special? And he said to me, "I liked it that the author didn't talk about Nazis. He talked about Germans." Now, my parents were very decent human beings. The apple did not fall far from the tree. But I could understand that sentiment. The only Jews the Houthis have known are the Israelis. It's a regrettable fact that they don't know, have never experienced any other kinds of Jews. I remember I once asked my mother, just out of curiosity, did you ever come into contact with a German who was decent? She thought hard and she said, I remember one German soldier. He had a kind of guilty look on his face. That was all she could remember. One. So it doesn't surprise me that she loathed all Germans. Do I wish the Houthis were more discriminating in their slogans? Of course I wish it. But do I understand where it comes from? Yes. And will that slogan of theirs color my appreciation of the fact that alone among the world's peoples, they are resorting to armed force to stop the genocide in Gaza? I have to ask myself the question, how would my parents have felt if this ragtag army happened to be situated on a point in the world's map where they could inflect the outcome of the final solution? And these people, this ragtag people, hailing back to the Middle Ages, they were investing all of their physical resources and moral energy to stopping the extermination. How would my parents react? Would they ask, what are their political slogans? I don't think so. That's my honest reaction. I'm not trying to be rhetorical with you. You asked me a concrete question. That's how I reasoned it through.
You heard highlights from a conversation entitled Norman Finkelstein and Chris Hedges Discuss Israel and Gaza. They spoke on March 28, 2024, before an overflow audience at Princeton University. Norman Finkelstein is the author of many books, including Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Chris Hedges was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times and a vocal critic of the invasion of Iraq. The Real News Network is independent and viewer-supported. You can find the almost two-hour-long recording of the event on YouTube under the title Norman Finkelstein and Chris Hedges Discuss Israel and Gaza at Princeton. Please support everybody involved. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.